Seeing these things like, can you sacrifice one life to save another? Tonight, we're going to talk about cosmetic surgery and extradition law, which are, you know, things that we always love to talk about here at the Manhattan Jewish Experience. Very random topics. Why are we doing this in this course called From Sinai to Manhattan? We're doing this for a very, very specific reason. We're trying to apply some of the principles that we've been discussing about how to actually understand the Torah. And I'm going to take you back to week one. What did we discuss week one? How do we know the Torah comes from God at all? We discussed that the first week. And then when we all became 100% intellectually and absolutely convinced of the divinity and authenticity of the Torah, we then asked a very simple question. Is that okay, but how do you read it? Because we got 30 people sitting in a room right here, and I'm sure I gave everyone the same verse, we'd all read it differently. How do we understand the Torah? So we talked about the oral tradition, which gives us a way to decode the messages, the deep, deep messages of the Torah, because we know some verses are read literally. I just gave a whole class about love your neighbor as yourself. We've all heard of that verse. So does the Torah really want us? What does that mean? To love your neighbor as yourself. Are you really supposed to love other people as much as... Is that possible even? I'm not getting into that now. But the oral tradition has a lot to say about that. And what happens when the oral tradition seems to be a little silent on a particular phrase or verse or letter, even in the Torah? So we talked about the 13 hermeneutical principles, these 13 logical devices that the sages of the Sanhedrin would use to interpret the biblical text to arrive at Jewish law. When we do that, what is that law? Does that law have a biblical or rabbinic status?
Rabbinic.
All right, has a biblical. Why does it have a biblical status? Because it's from the Torah. Just because the rabbis are interpreting it doesn't mean they made it up. We do have other laws written by the rabbis. What do we call those laws? Rabbinic laws. What's an example of rabbinic law? I'm just going to keep, reviewing because things get muddied over the weeks. No chicken parm. Because what does the Torah say? Does the Torah say anything about chicken parm? Now, what does the Torah say not to do? Not to eat, not to mix the kid in its mother's milk, which we all know refers specifically to
red meat.
And the rabbis came along just to make our lives more complicated and difficult and restricted, paint us into a corner, no chicken. Why? I'm being facetious.
Because at the time it was easy to
conceive. Even in our own time, I would argue, you go to a meat restaurant, they're serving chicken and meat, so they're a little more interchangeable than other things. And that's the difference between a rabbinic law and a biblical law. And we talked about that. And what I wanted to really do is give you real live examples of how we take these verses from the Torah, principles mentioned in the oral tradition, to actually solve problems and issues that we have in our everyday lives. Or just to be able to understand what the Torah means when it says, honor your parents. What does the Torah mean when it says, honor your parents? It also says, fear your parents. What's the difference between honor and fear? Now, that's a whole other discussion we can get into. The Talmud actually tells us. The Talmud is the written down part of the oral tradition. Before I jump into some more examples tonight, I want to take a few moments if anybody has any questions. Not about Dicephalus twins. Not about Siamese twins, we spoke the whole week last week about that, but just about everything we've been talking about. I don't want all these weeks to go by and I dazzle you with these really interesting examples, but you don't really get the principles. The principle of understanding the written text through the lens of the oral tradition. Yes?
Well, I was just wondering if there was any pre-Talmud oral Torah that didn't end up in the Talmud.
Yeah, I'm sure there's... I don't know, but I'm sure... Not everything that was passed down from generation to generation necessarily got written down. Okay? Who wrote it down initially? Who was the first person that actually broke the tradition that was supposed to keep it oral? What was his name? Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Rabbi Judah the Prince. And he... thank you guys. It's a pleasure. And he was the one that took it upon himself. Why did he do it? It's important to know.
Because the Jews were being exiled.
Right, he lived in the Roman period when they were starting to kick us out. We were starting to forget Hebrew. We were starting to speak other people's languages. And we were starting to forget the tradition. So he just said, you know what, I know there's this tradition against committing the oral tradition to writing, but he found another verse in the Torah based on a different oral tradition that said, sometimes in order to preserve the tradition, you have to break it. So he broke the tradition of not committing oral tradition to writing in order to preserve the Torah. And thank God he did. And the book that he wrote was called?
Mishnah.
The Mishnah. What does the word Mishnah mean? M-I-S-H-N-A. It's just, it actually means to review. Lishanot means to review, to go over things. He just wrote black letter law, just laws that people would review. Not much discussion, just like Rabbi so-and-so says this, Rabbi so-and-so says that. Some Mishnayot have some interpretation and analysis and debate, but most Mishnayot are just sort of straightforward. This is what he says, this is what he says. What's the Talmud?
Interpretation.
Right. Well, more. Keep going with that. What interpretation of what?
Of the Mishnah.
Taking those rules and laws in the Mishnah and starting to discuss them and apply them. What did we do here last week together as a group in trying to analyze, can you sacrifice one life to save another? You have these children that are born, they're fused in the ventral area, and you don't do anything, they're both going to die. You do something, you might be taking one of their life. How do you know what to do? We analyze, we discuss, we take the rules and the laws and we try to apply them. And that's really, I have to tell you, it's one of the most important things that so few people, in my opinion, get about Judaism. Because we get offended many times because we're like, this sounds like this, this sounds like that. And we just shoot from the hip. And even though we're comfortable in whatever field, whatever discipline we've studied, if you're a psychologist, you're a therapist, if you're a medical, you're a doctor, you're an attorney, you're in finance, every one of us had to go through some kind of rigorous training where we learned how to develop our skill through the scholarship in whatever field we studied, right? And you don't just walk in if you're, you know, you don't walk into a, you know, a conference of physicists and just say, well, I think it's this. You have to take all of the body of information and explain yourself within the context of the scholarship that has been developed, and that's what we do when we analyze these situations. We don't want to shoot from the hip. And even though, that's why I like the example last week, because you have two babies, and you know you can save one. But in order to save one, you have to take one of the baby's lives. That's going to die anyway. So I'm just going to do it. Because to my human logic, it makes sense to do that. And it does. But how do you know that's what God wants you to do? And if you don't know that that's what the Almighty wants you to do in that situation, then how do you know you're doing the right thing? How do you know that in your effort to save a life, you haven't done something called murder by taking another life? Well, because they're going to both die. But this one could live another couple of weeks. But by separating it, you're taking its life now. And who am I to say that the next 2 weeks of this baby's life, I have decided are not worth it because I want to save that other baby's life for many years to come? Human logic would dictate, take the baby's life. And that's what medical science and most medical ethicists do. But what we are trying to do is access God's wisdom as expressed in the Torah to know what to do in any given situation in our lives. Okay, and that's why we have this whole system. Okay, so I want to move on and I want to talk about two new things tonight. One is cosmetic surgery, and I'm not a scholar in medical ethics, but I've done a lot of reading. And there's a lot of, take a look on page 11 of your handout. I apologize for some of you who got the new handout. You might have 11, you might not have 11. You might not have it, but it's okay. You'll just follow along as best as I can. What is the issue with cosmetic surgery? I don't want to spend so much time on it, and I want to get into extradition.
You're altering what you were given?
Okay, you're unhappy with a part of who you are, and so what would be the problem? So fix it. If medical science says, you know, my nose is like this and I can make it look like that, then go for it. Like, what's the problem? What issue would there be as far as the Torah would be concerned, even before looking down?
Not natural.
What's that?
Just putting your life at risk.
Putting your life at risk. Okay, let's say the risk is minimal. It's still a risk, putting yourself under the knife. Good, that's one issue. You're not permitted to do anything that would harm yourself. Take a look at the first verse. V'nishmartem od l'nafshotechem, guard your souls very carefully. That's the verse that many rabbis quote as a basis to say that, let's say, smoking would be, according to many opinions, God bless you, prohibited under Jewish law. By the way, it gets political sometimes because, you know, in the 50s and 60s or 70s, when cigarette packages just had the Surgeon General warned that smoking may be hazardous to your health, which was a big hoax, which went on for decades. So a lot of rabbis were reticent to say that something that may be, according to the FDA, you know, unhealthy for you or hazardous to your health, you know, and you know, because eating fatty foods is also unhealthy. But we know, if you've ever been to a kosher kiddush on Shabbos, we know that, you know, not every kosher religious establishment eats so healthily. In fact, sometimes it's just the opposite. Just that's a cultural thing. I don't know why that is. It's not a good thing. And we get sucked into that too. I remember somebody came over to me like a few years ago, and he comes over, he's like a full plate of cholent. You know, it's like piping hot cholent from our kiddush. He says, "Rabbi, I have a really important halachic question." He says, like, "Love the cholent here at MG. It's so good, but it's just like I go home every Shabbos afternoon. I get like heartburn. It just, what do I do?" And I'm like staring at his cholent as he's telling me. I'm like, dude, stop eating the cholent. It's not that complicated. If you're getting, you know, whatever it is. So, so clearly, not everything that's a little unhealthy becomes prohibited. Okay. So that's cosmetic surgery is one possibility. That's one possibility why cosmetic surgery could be a problem. What else? Any other issues?
I have an issue with the verse.
What's the matter?
It says, guard your soul. Did you say about guard?
Exactly. The soul is so interesting that often when the Torah refers to the body, it calls it the soul. This is actually a pasuk that is interpreted by all of the opinions in the oral tradition as referring to your physical body, even though the Torah actually calls it the soul. It's another example of, again, we're not fundamentalists, because if you read this fundamentally, meaning literally, you would say, oh, this is not talking about my body. This is just talking about my soul, so I can do whatever I want to the body. The heck with the body. No. Rabbis teach, and the rabbis didn't make it up. This is an oral tradition passed down from generation to generation. And the second one also, guard your souls very carefully to love Hashem. And the Rambam, Maimonides, by the way, who was a physician, really believed that so much of Judaism was about leading not only a spiritually healthy life, but also a physically healthy life. And Maimonides has whole treatises about how to eat, how to sleep, how to do all these types of things, because he believed that Judaism was a recipe for a complete healthy existence, not simply for your soul, but also your body, which the Torah refers to here as a soul. What is another issue that could be, besides harming yourself? What if it wasn't dangerous, but what are you doing, actually, when you're through most cosmetic surgeries?
Modifying creation.
Okay, you're modifying the way God created you. It's a little more of a philosophical question than it is a legal one, but the rabbis will discuss this also. But let's say it's not... Let's say I go to I keep attacking you in class. I don't know why, but let's say I go to Daniel and I know whatever I'm going to hit him. He'll get a little bruise, but he'll be fine. It's not really dangerous if I give him like an uppercut.
This is rabbinic abuse,
right? So, so is that a problem if I hit somebody and it's not really dangerous? It's not dangerous. Would you consider getting hit dangerous?
You don't know when to stop. Is that a problem?
So that's like so. I'm glad you brought that up. It's actually a problem in and of itself. Just damaging someone, even if it's not a danger, it doesn't cause a danger. It's first of all, it's assault and battery. It's illegal, and under halacha, if causing a bruise to someone else is a biblical prohibition, you're not permitted to damage the body. By the way, we talked about abortion last week. So why is abortion forbidden according to the Torah? We talked about when it's permissible. Last week, remember we talked about the exception. But why is it in general forbidden? So most people think because it's considered what's called ritzicha, which is murder. Child has a right to life, all that. Some disagree. Some do not believe that the prohibition of abortion has anything to do with murder. They don't necessarily consider a child in utero a complete life. So why would it be forbidden according to those rabbis? Because it might be what's called in Hebrew chavala. Chavala means maiming. You're not permitted to maim yourself, God forbid, pull off a limb or an organ from your body. Those things also. So cosmetic surgery could involve some of these issues. So what I want to do with you is read a couple of tshuvot. Take a look. This is the wrong one. Maybe. Yeah, I think so. I think it is, actually. I got to find... I'm going to have to borrow somebody's... Give me 1 second. 11. Is that... If you're permitted to amputate a limb in order to save the body, 100%. Just like... 100%, and it becomes a mitzvah to do that then, if that's the only way to save, because you can do anything except for three specific situations to save a human life. I'm going to share with you, if that's okay.
Right.
So that's page 11. Let's turn to page 12, and some of you don't have page 12. And you're just going to imagine that it's there. Just be creative. Imagine a piece of paper with lots of Torah wisdom on it that you don't have. So... Take a look at source number 8. Source number 8, Maimonides says, the laws of the wounder. It is forbidden for a person to wound himself or his friend, and not only the wounder, but any man who strikes an ordinary man of Israel, whether minor or adult, whether man or woman, in an abusive manner, violates a negative precept. If you hit someone in an abusive manner, because you could hit somebody, right, to help somebody, let's say you just mentioned before, removing an organ, moving a limb, or what does a doctor do every time a doctor performs surgery? The doctor is actually causing a wound. So that's clearly permissible, because the Rambam says you're not permitted to perform a wound unless it's done, only if it's done in an abusive manner. And when someone, a doctor, is cutting somebody open, to perform surgery, they're not doing it to be abusive, they're doing it to heal. The question is, when a person goes through cosmetic surgery, can you say that this is kind of a healing? Because that's really what's involved. You're causing damage to the human body, which is forbidden. Would this be considered a healing? Healing permits the damage. It's not being done in an abusive manner. And of course, two Jews, three opinions. There are a couple of different opinions. Follow with me on page 12, which is the page 12. Okay, go to page of. Yeah, let's go to page 13 now. Now, I'm just going to share with you three different opinions. You guys with me? Three different opinions. The first opinion is Rabbi Eliezer Tzvi Waldenberg. He was born in 1917 and was a member of Israel's Supreme Rabbinical Court, and he was considered actually the rabbi of Shaare Tzedek Medical Center. That's Israel's premier hospital. In Jerusalem, and he wrote a lot of books and articles in the field of halacha, and he was best known for his decisions on medical issues, on fertility issues, on abortion, organ transplantation, euthanasia, autopsies, smoking, cosmetic surgery. Listen to what he had to say about cosmetic surgery. In my opinion, he says, there are ramifications of this regarding plastic surgery that doctors are currently performing on many people for the sake of beautifying their organs. He wrote this many years ago, by the way. And I'm reading an English translation that Rabbi Avi Heller wrote up, because none of these books are translated into English, but he took the time. So I want to thank Rabbi Heller. And he says that beautifying their organs, even when there is no sickness or pain. And there's a good basis to argue that it was not for this reason that the Torah gave permission to doctors to heal. You know, that the Torah actually, there are some religions that don't permit healing. You have to put all of your faith in God. Judaism is clearly not such a religion. The Torah says explicitly, "Verapo, yirape," and you shall heal. That is a charge to physicians to do what they have to do to heal. Hashem wants us to partner with Him in making the world a better place, creating cures for disease, healing individual people that are sick. So we're permitted to do that, and we're permitted to cause damage in order to heal, as we've discussed. The question is, can you call this healing? And it is not permitted, he says, to allow doctors to hurt you for this purpose, and there's no permission for the doctor to perform it, and one should know and believe that there's no designer like our God. And He designed and created every human being in their own form according to His image, and form which is instantiated within him, there's nothing to be added or taken away. It is clear there's no license except when wounding comes to heal and to return the loss of one's body, but not to wound the body in order to change it according to their wishes and to be, quote, smarter than the image of which his creator made. Okay, he is giving you a very... what is he saying? He's really... you can't do it. He's coming out very against cosmetic surgery for two reasons. What's the first reason? He says this is not healing. This is not considered healing. I'm going to go through all three approaches and then we'll take questions. This is not considered healing. And he says, and what are you doing? You're changing yourself. And Erica, you brought this up. It's a little more of a philosophical issue. Am I supposed to sort of just become satisfied with who I am, with the way I look, with the way God created me? And is it kind of an affront to God that I'm not happy with what he gave me, and therefore we have the technology now to change that? So he has an issue with that. He says there's no license except when wounding comes to heal or to return the loss of one's body, but not to wound the body, to change it and to be, quote, smarter than the image which the God, which his creator made, in order to renew their youth or destroy the edict of the king of the world. Moreover, beyond all doubt, it is absolutely forbidden for a person to bring themselves into danger for this. Therefore, it seems that according to Jewish law, as above, it's forbidden for a person to have plastic surgery, and also for the doctor to carry out such a surgery for the sake of beauty and the like. Whoa. Okay. Any plastic surgeon in the room, don't fret. Just turn the page. Okay. There are other opinions, but that's his opinion. Okay, we'll talk about it. That's opinion A. And that, his name was Rav Tzvi Waldenberg, great rabbinic scholar, lived in Israel, Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg. Now, what was the name of the rabbi that I discussed last week? Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. He weighed in on this issue too. Is it permitted for a young girl to beautify herself via surgery, which is bodily damage? I mean, I guess the question he was asked was in regard to a young girl, but I don't think it's particular to a certain age. He answers, but Maimonides writes... Now stop for a minute. Remember what the Rambam said? What did Maimonides say? You're not permitted to wound another person, but there was a caveat. In an abusive manner. Think about your favorite plastic surgery. Is that a wounding for abuse? So he says, Maimonides writes, any striking of a normal person of Israel, which is striking in an abusive manner, and one version of the Rambam, a degrading manner, and if so, then the fact is that this wounding is done for beauty. It is not an abusive or degrading manner, so the prohibition does not apply. But Moshe Feinstein says the exact opposite of the other rabbi. He holds that what's the only issue? He doesn't get into the whole philosophy of like you're being smarter than God and you think you should look like this and God said you should look like that. He doesn't deal with that. It's just a legal, technical, legal issue, which is abuse. You're not allowed to abuse physically another person or yourself, but it's only being not abused. You're not permitted to cause physical damage in an abusive manner, but this is not for abuse. This is to beautify someone. This is to make someone feel better about themselves. And therefore, according to Rav Moshe, it seems to be okay. I want to take two last positions, and then we'll take all your questions. Please remember your questions. Is that okay? Okay. Rav Breisch was born in Poland in 1896, served as the rabbi of a number of communities in Poland and Germany. In 1934, he fled from the Nazis, settled in Switzerland, where he served as the rabbi of the community. The first volume is Responsa. You know what a responsa? That's what I'm reading with you guys. It's called a Shiva. If you come to a rabbi and you ask me a question, your question is called a Shaila. My answer is called a Tshuva. So there were these great rabbis that would write letters. Because, before email or the phone, they would send a letter from Europe to America if the rabbi was here, or American usually in Europe, because all the big rabbis were in Europe, and they would write a question. And then the rabbi would research it and write what's called a tshuva, a responsa. Any lawyers here, it's kind of like a court opinion, like what a judge would have his or her clerk write up. They don't just give the answer yes or no, but a whole analysis. And it's great because a lot of tshuvas will take you through the whole, start with a verse from the Torah, give you the Mishnah, the Talmud, all the commentaries, and explain the great rabbi's line of reasoning so that when you're done, you can actually say, this is why the rabbi said no. This is why the rabbi said yes, or maybe, depends, you know? So this particular rabbi asked, is it permitted for a young woman to have surgery on her nose to straighten it and beautify it? This was a specific question about getting a nose job. And he said, in our case, we have both. For probably she's embarrassed by her nose to go with her friends. And since in general women are judged by their beauty, if so, there is no greater pain than this, so it is a clear halachic decision. This is just a paraphrase of his answer. What does he say? It's permissible. Why? He says, unfortunately, he's not even commenting. He says that people, particularly women, are judged for their beauty, and if she's in this kind of pain, and this is going to help rectify that on some level, he says no issue at all. Take a look at the last opinion, and that is Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. It's on page 15, those of you who have the packet, the one that's complete. Even though incomplete people have page 15, by the way. Even incomplete packets have 15. So you can read this one if you want. I'm sorry, I took your thing. I'll stop talking in a minute and we'll discuss it. Plastic surgery. By the way, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach was an awesome rabbi. He was born in Jerusalem in 1910, was recognized, actually, after Rav Moshe Feinstein died. I went to Rav Moshe Feinstein's funeral because it was my year in Israel. When I was 18, it was 1986, and I will never forget that funeral. First of all, I couldn't get anywhere near the actual building where the funeral was taking place. There were so many people. There were tens and tens of thousands of Jews from all walks of life. He was so beloved. He lived in the Lower East Side here, but he was buried in Israel, so they had a funeral here and they had one in Israel, I remember. And Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach was already a big rabbi by the time Rav Moshe passed away, and after he died, he sort of was then considered one of the world-renowned halachic authorities. And he's recognized as one of the great poskim. When he was 22, he published a book that dealt with all the problems of electricity and Shabbat. He really understood, from an engineering perspective, the mechanics of electricity, and wrote profusely about electricity issues having to do with Shabbat, which we'll get to when we get to our Shabbos. And he died in 1995. So what does he say? Plastic surgery, I'll respond to you briefly with my humble opinion, that in cases when it is not done for the sake of beauty, but because of pain and the like. You see, so far we've got two different positions. We got the first position, Rav Tzvi Waldenberg, who said, no. Okay, you can't cause this kind of damage to a person's body, it's not considered healing, and don't try to be smarter than God. The other two opinions, Rav Moshe Feinstein held it was perfectly okay, it's not considered damaging in an abusive manner, and Rav Reich also said because people are judged by the way they look, there's no greater pain and therefore it would be permissible. He kind of takes like a middle approach between the two approaches. He says that in cases when it's not done for the sake of beauty, now why would someone have plastic surgery not for the sake of beauty? He says because of pain, i.e. the nose is very deformed from ordinary people and he's embarrassed. He says then he says it's possible to be lenient. For the intention is to remove the defect so he can be like other men, and this is not similar to, quote, fixing women, so here too it's possible to be lenient. But in cases where the intention is simply to beautify, it would seem to be forbidden. The prohibition of wounding one's body seems to be not applicable when it is a case of repair. Repair is okay, beautifying is not. Just to take you from the way you are to make you a little better looking or prettier, he wouldn't permit, but he would permit if there was some kind of deformity or some kind of pain experience. Now, obviously, that could get a little gray, because a person could view a part of their body that one person sees as not a deformity, but just not as attractive as somebody else's nose or whatever it is. Obviously, that can get a little subjective. And I do think it would, I mean, you're asking I'm not anywhere near these rabbis, but I do know that your psychological state of being and how much you're affected by the way you look could be factored into here. But that's also a mixed bag, and that could get complicated because, you know, plastic surgery in some people's cases can become addictive, because if a person is just unhappy with themselves, okay, then unfortunately, this has happened many times, it's not a simple thing, but, you know, at least a physical repair you know, a person who considers it repair and it's really just beautifying and it's not going to the core issues, you have to be very, very careful in saying that, oh, the person really needs this psychologically. Sometimes it could be the worst thing for that person, or it could just be masking the real issues that the person needs to contend with, and which is not their nose or the size of this, that, or the other. It could be something deeper, or maybe not. And then maybe, according to these other rabbis, it would be permissible. Okay, that's all I have to say. What do you guys have questions or comments, please? Boris, yes, you've been very, very...
But you were first.
Ladies first, Erica.
Okay.
We'll be a gentleman.
Don't you think it's like permissible because, like, in terms of people beautifying themselves because they're doing it like for procreation? Like, if a woman's beautifying herself
right.
in order to procreate because she wants to attract her mate. Because, like, even when we were like in Egypt, leaving in the desert, there's a parsha, there's a line that says that women were breaking glass and putting rouge on their cheeks in order to attract the men, so that they wouldn't go to the other women, but that they would stay within the Hebrews.
Yeah, there's actually a very beautiful midrash that says that there was a certain mirror that the women used to beautify themselves, not because they were concerned that they would go towards the Egyptian women, but because their souls and their spirit was broken in the fields of Egypt. That's what the Egyptians were trying to do, and they just didn't have either the physical urge or the motivation to bring children into this. So the women went ahead and beautified themselves to make themselves more attractive, so that the husbands would want to have children to perpetuate, to have Jewish continuity. And by the way, that mirror was used in building the tabernacle, because it was considered such a holy and pure thing for a woman to make herself beautiful for her husband so they could have children. So there's no question that's a very important Jewish value. The question is, how far do you take it? How far do you take it? How beautiful does a person have to make themselves, you know, into, and how much under the knife should they risk in order to do that? And especially when you're not, according to the Torah, permitted to do anything that's dangerous. So that's why you do have to speak with a physician about this. It's not enough to just talk to the rabbi. You got to know what are the, what are some of the complications that could arise, God forbid, you know, from having any kind of cosmetic surgery. And that has to be then weighed against how important it is. Clearly, if it's a repair, it would seem like all the rabbis, I would think even maybe Rav Zvi Waldenberg, who didn't speak about repair, he was just talking about beautifying. It seems like if it's repair, and a deformity, then clearly it would be permissible. For the sake of beauty, Rav Moshe Feinstein says it's okay too, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach makes that distinction between deformities and for beauty, and Rav Reich also permits it. So you have halachic authorities that think it's okay, but you got to be careful with it, I think. Yeah, Boris, yeah, and then Yitzchak.
Well, I wanted to make a comment, and then I wanted to ask a question.
Can you just do the question? Because
okay.
I want to move on. I'm sorry. Yeah, go for it.
No question.
Yeah.
Basically, what she said, I don't know her name.
Erica,
yeah. And in a way that sometimes as a woman, it's important for her to be able to make some surgery, cosmetic, to beautify herself, and it can be the way a Jewish value, as long as she doesn't harm, as long as the side effects are not as bad in proportion to what she's getting as a reward. But let's say she has a nice husband and everything goes well, and then they have birth to two or three nice daughters, but unfortunately they're not pretty. Then maybe it would be nice for them in the future to do as well. Would that be like a Jewish value for them to make like this?
I don't think, I honestly don't. I'd be very careful to call it a Jewish value to perform cosmetic surgery, even though it is a Jewish value to be attractive to your spouse. And we all know that attraction is not skin deep, and we have to learn how to be attracted to other people, not simply based on the way they look. And there's an expression in Hebrew, Ein ledavar sof, because there's no end to this. If you take that attitude, and I'm not saying you're advocating this, but if you take that attitude that it's all about being attractive, then what happens when the person gets older? And they need another Botox, and they need another this, and another that. It's unhealthy, and it's and now you're really going up against, you know, Jewish values. And by the way, we're only talking about women, but we know that this applies to men just the same. This applies to men. You know, men can be very vain, and we could be very concerned the way we look also, and want to get a nose job, and want to get something else changed in our body that we're a little insecure about. So I think this I just wanted to mention that, but it's a great point. Yes, Chuck, what do you got? No, it's fine. Please.
No, I just think Moshe Feinstein, I think I read that Shabbat. I think he was really just speaking if someone was really psychologically
100%
in an extreme case, which wouldn't sort of be in the permit of like, oh, I'm insecure, or oh, I don't think I'm attractive. It was like a really psychologically debilitating issue.
I mean, he doesn't say that. He doesn't say you need grave psychological consequences. I'm reading what he says. He quotes the Rambam that it's chavala, which is maiming yourself, is only usur when it's done shu b'maka derech nitzayon, which is abusive, u'lechad girsa derech bizayon, and according to some it says bizayon, degrading. V'akorcha ba'uvda zu sh'chavala hu liputche lipituach, for beauty, you're doing the chavala for beauty. He says, according to the Rambam, and the Rambam was the one who codified, bless you, oral tradition, he just says it doesn't apply. But I can't imagine that Rav Moshe would have been so flippant.
You're right there?
Bless you. I wouldn't believe that Rav Moshe would be so flippant, you know, like, oh, anyone. Obviously, the person really feels they have to have this. You know, and then, you know, the person has to think, take some counsel with friends, talk to the doctor, and make a rational, informed decision. You know, so I hear what you're saying. I mean, I would.
I think part of the pain, that sort of the trepidation which I approach this question, is you don't want Moshe Feinstein to be a permit to this, to a culture, maybe a separate culture that might be consistent with Jewish values,
right?
About Nazism.
Right. Yeah. I right. It's a good point. I hope I'm not. I hope I didn't present Rav Moshe's opinion in such a way that it would just like, oh yeah, no problem, go for it, get as many cosmetic.
To some, I don't think that's what you were trying. But to some, yeah, they might be. Oh, Moshe Feinstein is sort of, you know,
right.
But it feels conditional. Though I haven't read the Tribune in a really long time, so I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Question.
Yeah. What about? I know we're talking about surgical, but what about medical? Like pills, do they, same thing, like a pill to make you lose weight?
No, that's less of a problem. Much less of a problem. There's no chavala there. The question is there side effects? Are there negative side effects? And that, you know, but much less of an issue. Yes?
Because this seems like it's unconsciously, the issue with this could be, depending on who it is, like worshipping another image of something else. I wonder if you could come under like Ten Commandments, the phrase of an image, an idol. You know?
Yeah, it would make for a good sermon on Shabbos, you know. But I don't think it would be. No, I mean that. I mean, but I don't think in a purely. I'm going to be a lawyer on you here. You know, in a purely legal halachic sense, it's not worshiping. It could become that.
An image.
Of course, you know that's you know. I think one of the reasons in the Hanukkah story, Hanukkah's coming up, the Greeks, you know, banned circumcision specifically, is that they viewed circumcision as an affront to their ideology, because you ever see like the Greek gods like Zeus and Hercules with these like perfect chiseled out, you know, physiques, because they worshipped the body, they worshipped the physical. That's what Hellenism was all about. That's what the Maccabees were fighting against. So I guess, you know, anything taken to an extreme. And this is certainly a good example. You take this to the extreme, it could be a form of idol worship. Certainly.
Perfection.
What's that?
Perfection versus nature.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't want to finish this without mentioning one thing. We are supposed to learn, as opposed to fighting reality, this is a whole speech I gave another time, but embracing our reality. We spend a lot of our time trying to play with a deck of cards as opposed to just accepting the deck of cards of life and learning to be happy with what we have. And that's something I think our generation really struggles with. So this is a very pertinent area, and I think we need to take that into account before jumping into some surgery. Am I really happy with myself, and is this going to change that? Yes?
Three questions, pick anyone you want to answer. Is it a contradiction that we're all created in God's image if we all look different? And some people.
Why would that be a contradiction?
Because it means God's ugly in some cases and beautiful in others.
I don't get it. When we say we're created in God's image, it doesn't mean God has any physical... I'm just passing around the extradition.
Well, I feel like we read things that suggested...
That what?
That it's like God's design.
Well, God's design, I mean, you can create an ashtray. I wouldn't say you and the ashtray have anything in common necessarily. You don't look like what you create necessarily.
Okay.
It's just a question of whether or not you are pushing back and saying, I'm not happy with what you gave me, God. And the truth is, we all do a little of that. Because none of us is entirely satisfied with everything we have in life. And that's one of the things we try to do through prayer, is to learn to accept and to learn to become happy with our current situation. What does it say in the ethics of our fathers, Ezehu Ashir, who is a rich man? So you figure, well, guy who makes 150, a guy who makes 250. No, Hasamech Bechalko, someone who's satisfied with what he has.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Second, are we allowed to do surgery for convenience, like getting your eyes fixed? It's not like beautification, but no longer having to wear glasses.
Oh, that's a good question. I actually had, when I was a kid, my parents didn't ask me, because I was really little, but I had strabismus, I had lazy eye, my left eye, and really poor vision also.
I had one just a couple months ago.
Oh, so you had surgery?
Yeah.
Oh, well, so I had cosmetic surgery, just to move, because my eye, and when I was really little, I saw all the pictures, my eye was like all the way over here, and the doctors recommended, I think there was a medical purpose to that too, not just that I would look a little strange or feel subconscious about it. So I think if it can improve your vision, you know, if it's, you know, and you don't need glasses or anything like that, then I think it's, I don't think you're getting into this issue. I think it's perfectly okay. You want to do everything to make yourself healthier, and you could take a knife to do that. Is it purely cosmetic, just so you don't have to wear glasses now, but it doesn't really improve, it's not better for your vision? Is that the case? I don't know. Anybody?
Well, I think
any opticians here? What's that?
It's more than that.
It's more.
Yeah. And it's not just not wearing glasses. It's also...
It also improves your vision.
It can improve your vision. But also, like, if you're stuck in the... If you're a camper.
Right.
Right.
Correct.
You can't.
Right, there'll be less accidents when you apply. I was always four eyes. I always had glasses since I was a kid. And I'm constantly, when I was a big ball player in elementary school, high school, and college, and it was always an issue, my glasses. Always, always an issue. So, yeah, that's another.
I'll save the last one.
Okay. Any other questions, cosmetic? Yes.
Yeah,
tell everyone your name. Your
Yeah, I'm Lisa.
Welcome, Lisa.
My first pair of the glasses. Hey.
Welcome.
So I don't, you know, that's a really good question. I don't know the answer. You'd have to weigh, because general anesthesia has come a long way, I'm told, than let's say it was 30 years ago. The risk is much less. Because I know they're just doing more surgeries today that they wouldn't do before because it was considered more of a risk. So I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that. Some risk is always okay. And by the way, some maiming the body. What about piercing? I thought someone was going to ask. How come you see very religious people have their ears pierced? Is that a problem? You're not allowed to maim the body. So it's considered beautification. Great. But it's still a maiming. Beautification is also having a nose job or breast augmentation or whatever it is. It's all beautification. Why is... There is a cost-benefit analysis. A tiny little hole in the earlobe is considered such a small little, you know, risk to one's health relative to the beauty that it brings. That's really what it's done usually. Yes, Michelle.
I have a question that is going to sound a little bit naive. So the first rabbi said that So I understand the thought behind not bruising yourself and not hurting yourself, but the whole concept of God made you perfect and you shouldn't alter yourself in any way, where exactly does that come from? And if that is the case, then isn't putting any kind of makeup on or any, like, breaking glass and putting blood on your teeth, wouldn't all of that be wrong?
It all depends on how, this is why, I'm so glad you asked it that way, because that's why we need the oral tradition. The Bible itself just says, v'nishmartem et nafshotechem, guard your soul, which the oral tradition says, don't do anything to harm the body. What does that mean? If it's not good for your skin to use, you know, certain type of makeup, but that's why I gave the example of eating cholent at a kiddush. So if it's giving you heartburn, you probably should stop. But if it's not so healthy. But nobody says eating cholent is forbidden on Shabbos. The biggest rabbis in the world are telling everybody to have some cholent and some whiskey. You know, my Zaidi, he should rest in peace. He used to start his morning off with a little. He was from the old country, stomach of iron. He would have schnapps. I used to see him in the morning. He'd like drink schnapps in the morning, smoke a cigar, break his Yom Kippur fast on red meat. He was just like, he was like an iron. Like, he was such a tough guy. He's from Bialystok. He was from Poland, Russia, Poland. And he lived, Baruch Hashem, he lived well into his late 80s, you know, 30 years ago. So none of those things are considered, and even the smoking wasn't really considered a danger in those days. Okay? So we don't go to that extreme and say you can't do anything that has any little slight, because then you can't drink. Okay, then you can't eat any food that is high in saturated fat. Then you can't put on any makeup because it could cause this, that, and you know what I mean? Like, you wouldn't be able to. So clearly the Torah permits that. What it prohibits is dangerous things. What is considered dangerous? And it is a little of a gray area, I will admit to you, and that's why we need halachic decisors. There are still rabbis who think that smoking is okay, that it doesn't cross the line. Most rabbis think it crosses the line, at least what we know today. In fact, Rabbi Tendler, the rabbi who was the go-between C. Everest Koop and Rav Moshe Feinstein, he said that his father-in-law, Rav Moshe Feinstein, if he was alive today, he would have for sure said that smoking is forbidden according to Jewish law, based on what we know on its direct causation to lung cancer. But when he was alive, that was being debated and discussed, and it wasn't so clear. Maybe it was, and we got hoodwinked, I don't know. So it's just a question of something has to really be dangerous. I thought someone was going to ask this also, can you go bungee jumping or any of these kind of extreme sports if there's any kind of danger involved? You know, one of my kids...
Can you be a Jewish daredevil?
Can you be a Jewish daredevil? It depends what you're daredeviling. You know what I mean? And what because a lot of things are not necessarily... I remember we went away for Passover like a few years ago, and a bunch of the guys from the hotel were going, and my oldest son, who has no fear, so he just like, he wanted to go there. Some guy from the hotel was taking like six or seven teenagers up in a plane, and they were all jumping out of the plane. I mean, they had parachutes, but I'm like, I don't want you getting, no, I mean, like not in the army, there's no need for you to do this, this is just a thrill. We'll find a thrill in another way, you know? I don't know. Again, it's gray. Everything is a cost-benefit analysis. But once something is considered dangerous, it usually becomes forbidden. Unless there's a countervailing need. Health trumps. Okay? But let's say it's beauty, and that's what we were discussing tonight. One other thing I want to mention, which is really important, and this could be... it's a big area of controversy. One of the things that Judaism assumes is that the body is on loan. And this goes very much against our contemporary society's view of a person's body and their own rights to make decisions like abortion and the like. We don't view our bodies as entirely as our own. We view them as gifts from God. And therefore they have to be treated in a certain kind of way. Which is why also, God forbid, a person dies. What do we do with the body? The body no longer has a soul. You would say the body is only significant as long as it has a soul. No, the body has to be treated with the utmost dignity and respect. And the body was literally on loan, and we have to treat the body as a temple. There is such an expression. And we don't treat the body simply the way we feel. And that's a big, I think, distinction in Jewish tradition and in our contemporary society. And there are a lot of, you know, dancing around this, but yeah. Question? Did you have a question? Oh, I thought so. Yes?
About cosmetic surgery to remove a tattoo.
So you're not required to remove, you're not permitted technically to get a tattoo. Okay, and the Torah just says it explicitly. It doesn't give us the reason. I would assume, I mean, this is just my speculation, that injecting dye into the body is not considered healthy. I know tattoos are very in, and I'm not trying to offend anyone who has a tattoo. I have a lot of friends who have tattoos. But once you have one, you don't have to have it removed. The prohibition, technically, is not having it. It's getting it. You know what I'm saying? So, to put yourself through, there was a guy actually came to MGE, a lot of tattoos. He happened to be someone who converted to Judaism, and he didn't want to go to the mikvah for the conversion. And he became a very religious guy, and he wanted to go to the mikvah every Friday before Shabbat, and he was embarrassed. And I said, if you're really embarrassed, then you can, but you're not required to do that. And people can understand that you had the tattoo before you came into this whole thing or whatever. But there's no requirement to have it removed. But if a person would like to have it removed, then, you know, that's great. But, I'm told it's not such a simple thing. You know, but there's no requirement. Yes?
Is it not halakhically sound?
You're really quiet here. Sorry.
Yeah. Is it not halakhically sound for a Jew to summit Everest?
I don't know how dangerous it is to summit. You mean to climb?
Yeah.
Is that a fancy word to climb?
Yeah, to get to the top.
Get to the top. The summit's the top.
Exactly. It's extraordinarily dangerous.
It might be an issue. So, but it would depend on who you are. No offense, but it might be dangerous for you and me to summit Mount Everest.
Wait,
but
Jews can't do things that are dangerous?
Correct.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
What?
Where you been, dude? We've been talking this for now. I mean, the Torah says guard your body. If you do something that could put your body at risk, and there's a
but
decent...
But most things that are fun are dangerous.
Well, depends.
So no skydiving, no
I don't.
Hiking,
I didn't say that.
No.
I didn't say skydiving. If you go with an instructor and there's been no instance, maybe that's not considered dangerous. I don't know. You got to analyze every
single
thing.
No, going into space? Like, what's the deal with, like, astronauts?
I don't know.
That could be extremely dangerous.
Space travel. I don't know. How dangerous is it to go into space?
It's pretty dangerous.
Is it dangerous?
It's been juicy.
Okay, hold on a second. But every situation.
Yes, I agree.
Every situation has to be weighed against why are you going into space as opposed to jumping out of a plane.
What about being in the military?
Stop for a second. One second. You're going into space because maybe through our interplanetary discoveries we can somehow come up with a cure for blah blah blah, and there might be more of a reason to put yourself in that dangerous situation than bungee jumping, which is just a thrill. So you have to analyze two things: is it dangerous, and why are you doing it? What's the toilet? What is the purpose of this? Simply to do it because it's fun, that's never going to justify it.
You can be in the military. It's extremely dangerous, but because you're doing it for a cause.
You're protecting liberty and justice and people's lives from being overtaken by maybe a tyrannical force in the world. Yeah, so that you might even be able to sacrifice your life for that, possibly. It all depends why you're doing it, 100%. There's no absolutes here. There's no, like, it's never okay to put yourself into danger. Obviously not. And that's what we were discussing in terms of... Okay, let me do a little of extradition. This is an area, actually, I have a little of an expertise in. And I gave myself 10 minutes to talk about it, which is just great. So if you have a handout, it's on page 16, and I just passed around a source sheet. Stuff going around. There's a handout going around. So let me just tell you the story. We'll get into this and maybe we'll pick it up next week. I don't want to keep it here all night. So when I was in graduate school, I studied international law and human rights. I had a whole trajectory that I was supposed to do, and you know, life happens. And I got to, I requested to intern in the human rights department of Israel's Ministry of Justice. The law school I went to actually had a program where you could go to and spend a summer in Israel's Ministry of Justice, which is in East Jerusalem, Rehov Salah Adin, in a pretty Arab part of town. And you can work on responding to human rights, allegations of human rights violations lodged by two groups, Amnesty International and the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. And I love that stuff. It's very interesting because Secretary of State just came out with this interesting statement about the territories. So I was very into all that stuff. And I got accepted into the program, and I was really excited. I was going to help the Israeli government respond as a budding attorney in a legal sense to these allegations that Israel was violating Palestinian rights in the territories. I booked a flight. I got an apartment in Yerushalayim. I was very excited, and I got to the office. I got to the Ministry of Justice, and I'm waiting there, and I find out that the internship program for the Human Rights Division was oversubscribed. I was the last person to show up that day, which for me, of course, was very uncharacteristic. Anyway, they told me to wait outside, and I was like freaking out. This is my whole summer, I'm supposed to get credit for this. I rented an apartment, I paid my own money to get there. I was like, they're like, I'm sorry, there's no room. Very like Israeli matter of fact, you can go now. I'm like, so the guy saw I was upset, and he says, wait here. And 5 minutes later, he comes out and he goes, come with me, I found you a new internship. These internships were very serious, as you can see. He found me one in 3 minutes. this is Israel, you know? And I'm walking after him through all these corridors, and he says, you're going to work here? Hasgara. I said, thank you. I may believe I knew what the word Hasgara meant. I'm so honored to work with Hasgara. I've always wanted to be doing legal work with Hasgara. And I'm in the office there, and I'm thrown into this office, like, I don't know, four or five lawyers, mostly Israelis, one American guy, and I went out, I was like, dude, what's Hasgara? He goes, extradition. I said, oh, what's that? He goes, Jews from other parts of the world who are accused of committing crimes and run to Israel. We are the department that sends them back in accordance with our international extradition treaties, if we have a treaty with a country. Most of them are American Jews who commit crimes, and we send them back. And I said, oh, great, that's amazing. And I was standing there, and he sees my yarmulke. He says, he goes to me, he goes, is that going to be a problem? He was a lawyer from Kansas City. Conservative Jew who made Aliyah in the 1970s, very smart guy, very nice guy. And I said, there's never been a problem. And I wouldn't imagine it should be a problem here in Yerushalayim. But I didn't see any other yarmulkes. And I didn't quite understand what was going on. And then he pointed to an article that he posted on his wall. And the article was a article written about the Rabbanut, which is the chief rabbinate's vehement opposition to Israel's policy of sending Jews back to foreign countries to stand trial. And I didn't really know what to do. I knew very little about Israel's policy on extradition, and I didn't really know what the halacha was either. So I called my rabbi back in Forest Hills, Queens, where I'm from. And I was like, Rabbi, I think there was no room in the human rights thing that put me in Hasgara. Is that a problem? And right away, he got it. He like knew exactly what I was talking about. And personally, it wasn't so much of an issue for me, you know, because I wasn't really sending anyone. I was just like an intern. I was like a little cog in the big... What are you a cog in? You're a cog in the big
wheel.
The wheel, right. And, you know, I was just going to be doing research. I spent most of my time at Hebrew University doing research having to do with other European countries and their extradition treaties, which I loved and I was very interested in. But it bothered me that people in this department, none of whom were observant, came to view rabbis and ultimately halakha as a system that wasn't serious about crime. I would occasionally overhear snide remarks about how rabbis and Jewish law seem to be more concerned about protecting Jews than they were about adjudicating justice. So I began my first exposure to this very controversial modern-day issue of extradition and halakha. Now, again, this is a great example. Somebody commits a crime in the United States, and they run away to Israel. They haven't stood trial, so we have to say they've allegedly committed a crime. Okay? They haven't been convicted. They run to Israel. Why do they go to Israel? Anybody know?
Aliyah.
They all of a sudden became a Zionist?
No, they were Jews, and they can claim Aliyah.
Okay, if you're a Jew, very good, you can claim the right of return, and you're now an Israeli citizen. Now, they're not evading trial. They know they've been accused of a crime. They want to sit, and they want to actually have the trial in Israel. They don't want to be... Now, the United States, and in many cases, the FBI is running after somebody, and they want to try the person. They want to prosecute the individual on American soil, where the crime was committed, allegedly. That's where the witnesses are. There's rules of jurisdiction. But you should also know that it's not such a simple thing. Most European countries, even if they have extradition treaties, will require their own people... In other words, they will not send back somebody. Many European countries have this law to this day. Israel, almost since its establishment in 1948, entered into many extradition treaties. But in 1977, actually, Menachem Begin introduced a law that barred the extradition of Israelis accused of committing crimes abroad. He did this, basically, to protect... litigation that was motivated by anti-Semitism. But it only applied to someone who was an Israeli citizen at the time that they were accused of committing the crime. And that law was then overturned in April of 2000. I'm not going to bore you the whole thing. The Talmud, the oral tradition, tells us that it is forbidden to send a Jew back to a foreign sovereign to stand trial. You're not permitted. It's called Mesira La'akum. You're not permitted to take a fellow Jew and to turn them over to the authorities. Now, if you take a look at the handouts that you have before you, the question is whether their policy of extradition poses a problem as far as halakha is concerned. Torah sources clearly indicate there is this prohibition, but the nature of the prohibition and its parameters are not 100% clear. It seems as though the prohibition might be because of what Menachem Begin was concerned about. Because when Jews usually were sent to a sovereign government to stand trial to another country, or in the same country, maybe you're living under Roman rule, and the Romans came for you, there was no system of due process. And it even applies today. Would you send somebody back to Iran if somebody was accused of a crime in Iran?
Absolutely.
And he came and he ran to Israel or the United States? And he had to be tried by the laws of the United States that has due process, would you send him back to Iran? It's not so clear that we would do this in all circumstances. And in fact, though, if you take a look at the first source sheet, there are passages that indicate in the Talmud that turning over a fellow Jew, or even his property, is absolutely forbidden. But there are two other passages, refer to the handout 1 and 2, that involve Talmudic sages who seem to have actually served as policemen for the Roman government, physically turning over Jews to the Roman authorities for prosecution. Look at the handout from the Talmud. Rabbi Elazar, son of Rav Shimon, was accordingly sent for, and he proceeded to arrest the thieves. He was arresting people for the Romans. A rabbi policeman. Thereupon, Rabbi Yeshua, the son of Karcha, said, "Vinegar, son of wine." How long? That's like an ancient shukim finishing up. That's an ancient rank out, by the way. If you want to really rank on someone, you call him Vinegar, son of wine. How long will you deliver up the people of our God for slaughter? Back came the reply, "I weed out the thorns from the vineyard." Whereupon Rabbi Yeshua retorted, that the owner of the vineyard himself will come and weed out the thorns. So it's interesting that Rabbi Elezer, Rabbi Shimon, and take a look at the second source. Also, similar thing befell Rabbi Shimon, the son of Rabbi Yossi. One day, Elijah the prophet met him and started rebuking him. How long will you deliver the people of God to execution? How are you doing this? How are you sending Jews back to stand trial? Someone else, it's not an appropriate thing. And the guy said back, what can I do? It looked like he was being forced to do this. And he says, well, you should run away. You shouldn't allow yourself to be put in a situation where you're forced to turn over fellow Jews. Now, both Rabbi Elezer ben Shimon and Rabbi Shmuel ben Yossi were reprimanded. But some of the commentaries say on this Talmud that this criticism does not necessarily imply that they acted in violation of halakha, of Jewish law. In fact, the Ritva and the Rashba, two important commentaries, explain that what they did was halachically permissible, but not the way of the pious. It wasn't great that they were doing it, but technically it was permissible. Halachically it was permissible. Why? Because how are you supposed to have justice if people are just committing crimes and then they can run away to some country and hide behind the law of return? There needs to be some kind of system of justice. And the Rashba recognizes a certain, has anyone ever heard of this concept? Dina, and I'm going to end with this because it's getting late. And Dina de Malchuta Dina. The law of the land is the law. As Jews, we are taught to respect the sovereign legal authority of the country in which we live. However, the Talmud says, welcome Rabbi, the Talmud says, Dina de Malchuta Dina, the law of the land is the law, but Dina de Gazlanuta Lav Dina, which means, what's Gazlan? What's a Gazlan? A Gana? A thief? But let's say it's a corrupt system. Right, you have to pay taxes, but let's say you find out that half the taxes that you give the United States government, the guy who comes to your house for the taxes is pocketing half the money. Are you still required to give taxes according to the law of the land? You have to respect the law of the land when it's completely corrupt? You do not. So, these are the kinds of issues that we had to contend with, and I'm just going to really conclude with this. I have so much more to say about this, but essentially, if the only way for there to be justice is for there to be Jewish policemen who need to turn in their fellow Jews who are committing actual crimes that are in violation of the Torah as well, then it becomes perfectly permissible to give over a fellow Jew to the authorities. I mean, what happens if you find out that a friend or someone has committed a crime? Do you turn them in? Is that permissible? Is that appropriate? Or what happens if you don't turn them in? What is the cumulative effect of the entire Jewish community turning a blind eye to illegal activities? And what happens to Israel? And I argue this, if anybody's interested, I wrote a 50-page paper for this when I was in law school, of why Israel's extradition treaties need to be upheld. Israel cannot become a safe haven for criminals. On the other hand, if it could be argued, as it was in some cases, that an individual is being persecuted or prosecuted without due process of the law, and it's motivated by anti-Semitism, then it becomes absolutely forbidden to do this. Just like you would never send a fellow Jew back to stand trial in Iran, because they have there's no due process there. You would never do that. So it's not simply a black and white issues. And whether that means extraditing the accused or having him tried in Israel, either way it has to be done in a way that not only seeks justice, but there's another issue. And that is the concept of Chil Hashem, of God forbid, causing a bad name for God. Because that's the experience I had in the office where I was. They kind of assumed that rabbis or Orthodox Jews were just light, you know, not taking justice seriously. So it's a very, very big issue. It's still an issue that takes place in Israel. But, you know, you talk to survivors or anyone who's been subject to persecution, they might think twice before sending somebody back to stand trial in another country, because they're so convinced that the Jew will never be treated fairly. And that is still an issue, you should know. So it's not a black and white issue at all. I don't want to take any more time from the awesome, awesome teacher you're going to be able to hear in just a few minutes. So I will be around, and I'll pick this discussion up next week. Again, we'll do a few more minutes of this next week. And I think next week actually is Erev Thanksgiving, is that right? So there will be class. If you can't make it, we understand. You might have to prepare your turkey. But we're going to, I'm going to finish this up, and then we're having a whole conversation about Jews observing non-Jewish holidays, like New Year's and Thanksgiving and Halloween and that fun stuff. That'll be our discussion, and we're going to use the oral tradition again to come to those conclusions. Thank you all for listening. Join us this Shabbat. By the way, fellows and everyone else here, we want to see you guys on Shabbos. FNL every Friday night, 6:45. It's awesome. Shabbat morning. I'm working on something really interesting for a talk about Sarah, our matriarch. We have some really amazing, wonderful stuff going on. And there's also a Minyan Madness on Sunday morning as well.
Yeah, Sunday morning, yeah. There's going to be a bunch of people going.
If anybody's interested in Minyan Madness Sunday morning at 9:15.
9 o'clock,
not 9:15.
I'm going to make a quick announcement. I apologize.
Please. No.
Just for Rabbi Liebtag, you can take a break in a minute, but I just want to do it for Rabbi Liebtag. Rabbi Liebtag in the back. I've had the awesome, wonderful opportunity of being able to go to Israel with MJE, and with him being one of the leaders. See, he leads the trip, and like basically half the fellows already gave in their deposit, which is pretty awesome. It was excellent. So Rabbi Liebtag is a teacher of teachers. He founded the Tanakh Study Center. He's an internationally acclaimed biblical scholar and pioneer of Jewish education on the internet. He has essays in the Parsha of the Shavuot of every single Parsha. He learned in the Gush Etzion. He was a rabbi there. He helped start this place called Ofrah. Oh, not Oprah. That was something else. Ofrah is LA. He basically teaches Tanakh to women at Midrash at Lindenbaum. He teaches at Yeshivat Shalabim. And it's a wonderful school. So I was in this class upstairs. I'm not going to be able to say it for this class, but that's Rabbi Liebtag. You're dismissed for several minutes, moments. So compose yourself. And Rabbi Liebtag will be teaching momentarily.
Jordan,
I didn't know what was happening.
I didn't recognize the temple, so it was like in the back. It was a mess tonight.